The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator. I'm Fraser Nelson. For our audio reads this week, we've got Douglas Murray reading his cover story in defence of liberalism. Then we've got Matthew Paris, who takes a rather different view and celebrates the toppling of statues, an exhilarating form of art, he says. And finally, Kate Andrews, our economics correspondent, on what she thinks people on her side of the political divide don't quite understand about what's happening in her native America. First, Douglas Murray.
It has become fashionable in recent years to talk of the death of liberalism. But as crowds high on the octane of generational self-righteousness rampage through major cities, the evidence mounts. The growing intolerance of freedom of thought, the inability to talk across divides, the way that most of the British establishment, police included, feels the need to pledge fealty to the cause, as though all terrified of ending up on the wrong side, points to a crisis of more than confidence. It is evidence of an underlying morbidity. Each day, the Cultural Revolution is picking up apace, with the iconoclasts who attacked the cenotaph and the statue of Winston Churchill looking for new focuses for their rage. The University of Liverpool has announced that its Gladstone Halls of Residence will be renamed after protesters pointed out that the former Prime Minister's father had owned slaves. So there goes the sins of the father ethic too. Nervous broadcasters have started removing programmes ahead of any stampede, with the BBC withdrawing Little Britain and HBO taking out Gone with the Wind from their streaming services in case the woke eye of Sauron flashes on them. What we are seeing is nothing more or less than the death of the liberal mind. Of course, liberalism was always a broadly defined term, a definition made only vaguer by Americans making it synonymous with left-wing. But in the truest political sense, it encapsulates most of the foundations of our political order, including, though not limited to, equality, the rule of law, and freedom, including the freedom of speech that allows good ideas to win out. In the past few years, left-wing critics have been keen to identify what they see as the erasure of liberal democracy by popularly elected leaders on the political right. But in our own country, the much more serious assault on political liberalism comes not from the conservative right, but from the radical left. Over the past couple of weeks, well-meaning people have poured almost £1 million into the coffers of Black Lives Matter UK in the belief that they are helping a movement that will help black people. In fact, they have funded a deeply radical movement. On its own fundraising page, BLM UK describes its aims as to dismantle imperialism, capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy and the state structures. So, as well as dismantling a non-existent menace, imperialism, it intends to bring down the economy and completely alter relations between the sexes, negatively characterised as patriarchy. This is not liberalism, but far-left radicalism, of a kind that has become very familiar of late. Some people watching events of recent days will have been surprised by how far and fast such sentiments have run, by the sight of a mob in Bristol tearing down a statue and then jumping on it, by a Labour MP saying, "I celebrate these acts of resistance, we need a movement that will tear down systemic racism," by the ranks of British police who could find no way to respond to this behaviour other than, in a newly invented act of faith, to take the knee before it. And then there is the media, which has chosen to provide cover for such violence and purge from their ranks not just people who dissent from it, but, in the case of the New York Times a few days ago, anyone who helps publish someone who dissents. As one of the last liberals left at that newspaper, Barry Weiss, explained it last week, the over-40s in the news business, like so many others, imagined that the people coming up under them shared their liberal worldview. Then they discovered that these young people believed in safetyism over liberalism and the right of people to feel emotionally and psychologically safe over what were considered core liberal values, like free speech. Actually, the divide is even bigger than that, and now encompasses nearly everything. Where the liberal mind is inquiring, the woke mind is dogmatic. Where the liberal mind is capable of humility, the woke mind is capable of none. Where the liberal mind is able to forgive, the woke mind believes that to have erred just once is cause enough to be cancelled. And while the liberal mind inherited the idea of loving your neighbour, the woke mind positively itches to cast the first stone. Readers of The Spectator have known this was coming. When this magazine first wrote about the Stepford students, it was asked why we take this so seriously. Surely the students would grow up. And they did. But they didn't change. The virtue signalling of large corporations, the growing legions of diversity officers and implicit bias training, was also written off as the silliness of the corporate world. When we described the mandatory requirement in government to prove a commitment to diversity in order to be eligible for any public appointment, it was greeted with the same dismissal. As the American journalist Andrew Sullivan, himself now seemingly muzzled, if not cancelled, put it 2 years ago. We all live on campus now. Step by step, the UK came to have a public and private sector dedicated to the implementation of views which are barely distinguishable from those of the protesters who took to the streets in the past week or two. It's an ethic which demands that our society play a set of impossible, unwinnable games of identity and privilege that not only subvert but end any idea of tolerance. All of this emanates from those who come out of university educated to loathe our society, believing it to be characterised by the oppression of certain groups by other groups, a shameful history and a shameful present. Today, these people head into professions where their language of aggressive superiority, educate yourself, is used to intimidate their elders, force everyone to agree with their point of view, and otherwise make themselves unsackable. As with all movements that catch, they aren't on to nothing. Inequalities and inequities do exist here, as in all societies. Reasonable people disagree about how to address this, but the new illiberal radicals do not share that worry. For them, every inequity that exists, financial, familial, social, neurological, is the result of the same thing, discrimination. A thing we must tackle, eradicate, and otherwise cleanse from existence. There's an awful lot of work to do. Even the woke analysis of history that now sees them scouring the land for more statues to assault is radically different from that of the liberal mind. Liberals understand that people in history acted with the knowledge they had at the time, and that the task of those looking back is to look on it with understanding, not least in the hope of being understood in turn. The woke mind abhors this. It knows that it is right, and that everybody before this year zero was a bigot. After the weekend's vandalism against London monuments, the capital's mayor, Sadiq Khan, announced that his Commission for Diversity in the Public Realm would sit in judgment on all racist statues in the capital, Within hours, the Museum of London had already brought in the cranes to remove an errant statue on West India Quay. In such ways has the free exchange of ideas about our past and present been replaced by a series of demands and assertions that demand everyone else's compliance. Silence is violence, is one favoured line, meaning that if you do not agree with the radicals, you are perpetrating an act of violence. Naturally, this assertion comes from the same people who have spent a lot of time asserting that words, such as misgendering someone, are violence, while the violence of the past few days is not violence. It is on the lip of this trap that our representatives and public figures have teetered over the past week or two, unable to work out how they can avoid a step they intuit to be deadly. What they need to do is pause and fundamentally change the terms, basing their appeal not just on reason, but on a truly liberal spirit. It should be one which emphasises that the claims being made are unjust. It is unjust to portray the whole of American society, in all of its complexity, as typified by a policeman who is awaiting trial for murder. And it is even more unjust to think that his actions reveal some deep truth about the British police or the British state, let alone everybody who is white. Equally, it is not just unjust, but vindictive, to pretend that any contradiction of your world view is merely a display of white privilege, white fragility, or white tears. Unwittingly or otherwise, those who use these terms subvert one of the last great additions to liberal thought, that aspiration expressed by Dr. Martin Luther King half a century ago. For when Dr. King talked about the need to judge a person by the content of their character and not by the colour of their skin, he gave us something that was not just a great moral insight, but, in an increasingly diverse society, the only solution. A year before his death, Dr. King gave a speech titled "Where Do We Go From Here?" in which he said, "Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power." The people who have come after Dr. King have spent their years busily inverting that dream. In the name of black agency, they try to deny white people agency. In the name of assailing white supremacy, they end up by asserting black supremacy. And in order to make up for the sufferings of people who are no longer alive, they demand vast wealth transfers today, based on racial grouping. It is hard to imagine a more divisive program, all carried out in the name of anti-racism. What they are actually doing is busily re-racializing our societies, which is how you come to the situation where a cabinet minister is quizzed on Sky News about the precise ethno-racial composition of the British cabinet, and certain anti-racists can be found on social media noting with disapproval the number of people of Asian descent in the cabinet. Any movement that says things are so bad that this whole thing needs to be pulled down should be encouraged to realise, before they have to experience it, the cost of what they are abandoning, and to remember the central truth about how much easier it is to pull down than it is to build. They must be responded to by people of every skin colour and background, with a polite but firm no. Not just because the things that they are attempting to pull down include the only things that are capable of holding us all up, but because if everything that got us here was so bad, then what we are living in wouldn't be so unusually good.
That was Douglas Murray, and now Matthew Paris.
I couldn't disagree more with Sir Keir Starmer. It was completely wrong. It shouldn't have been done in that way. Or with Boris Johnson. If people wanted the removal of the statue, there are democratic routes that can be followed. No, there was something magnificent about the sight of the Bristol mob throwing into the harbour the statue of a man whose trade was notorious for throwing sick slaves with no monetary value into the sea. 1890s Britain raised that statue. 1890s Britain, the decade in which my grandparents were children, for heaven's sake, had only just closed the slave market in Zanzibar. And if you want to know more about that stain on our fairly recent history, read Alistair Hazel's enthralling, horrifying The Last Slave Market, Dr. John Kirk and the Struggle to End the East African Slave Trade. If we're entitled to feel pride at the achievements and virtues of our forebears, why should we not feel shame at their sins? If there is significance in erecting monuments to those we admire, who can deny the significance of tearing down monuments to those we don't? Be honest. The sculpting of a massive representation of Sir Edward Colston for public display was not an exercise in either history or biography. It was a salutation, plain and simple. And if 1890s Britain was free to raise a monument to a man whom many of the residents of Bristol wished to salute, 2020s Britain should be free to raise two fingers to a man whose memory their successors hate. Toppling that statue was not an attempt to erase history, as disgruntled Conservatives like to mutter. Of history, the moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. No, that statue was not about history, but estimation. Our era is entitled to its own response. Far from this being a writing out of history, it was a writing in of history. History is what happened. How dreary, then, to recommend that instead of letting people show their passion unbidden and unminuted, the statue should instead have been demoted by a deliberative committee of municipal worthies, followed by the sending of a van with council workers in high-vis jackets and the dispatch of the bronze to some dull and unvisited corner of a museum somewhere. Sir Edward went out not with a whimper, but with a bang. And the video of that statue going into the harbour is now already in the modern museum that is the internet. That day has become itself history. History made not by an item on the agenda for councillors and bureaucrats, but by the impulse of an angry crowd. Watching the videoed scene of the mob toppling the bronze Sir Edward over the quayside last week, I felt a kind of thrill at the beating heart of human beings responding viscerally to a piece of art. The statue, of course, was no more than an item of fairly unexceptional art. It served as proxy, as heroic sculpture does, for its subject, in this case, Sir Edward. But then, serving as proxy for the things it may represent is what a great deal of art is all about. Just as it is good when art lifts, inspires, ennobles, and pleases us, it's good, too, when art infuriates, hurts, or inflames. Good in both cases because art has engaged. As something in me resonates at people's rage against a material object serving as proxy for what they hate, so I also thrill to people's rage against art itself, art they do not like. For this, too, is a function of art, to engage. In November 1954, on his 80th birthday, Winston Churchill was formally presented with his portrait by one of our most notable 20th century artists, Sir Graham Sutherland. The painting, in my view a masterpiece, is of a figure at the same time peevish and heroic, obdurate and defiant, fat, bull-necked and irascible, with a hint of hurt in the eyes. The portrait is completely and infuriatingly him. His political enemies tended to think it was rather good, his friends mostly took the other view. Churchill detested it, said it made him look like a drunk propped up from the gutter, accepted this gift of both houses of Parliament with what grace he could muster, not a lot, took it to Chartwell and sent it down into the basement. After Lady Spencer Churchill's death, it emerged that she had had it removed and burned. I call that act of aggression against art a triumph for art. Art should delight, wound, or enrage. Lady Spencer Churchill's vandalism was the ultimate tribute to honest portraiture. I see the whole episode as a celebration of the power of figurative representation to arouse passion in the breast of the viewer, and passion will take its natural course. Sutherland's art had cut his subject to the quick. Sutherland was entitled to his artistic response to Churchill, and the Churchills were entitled to their response to him. This is where art should be, not on elaborate plinths or the walls of hushed galleries, but at the centre of attention and human passion. Whether the passion is sympathetic or antipathetic is secondary. Heroic sculpture is multidisciplinary, hovering between art, craftsmanship, and historical tribute. Colston's bronze, like Sutherland's oils, is a commentary. To see these commentaries engulfed in the flames of a wife's anger or drowned by the Bristolians in Bristol Harbour is to see art come out of the galleries and textbooks and tourist snapshots and into our hearts and spleens. Thus perished most of the innumerable monuments to General Franco that I remember from parks and squares in pre-1970s Spain. Thus came down the statue of Saddam Hussein, whose toppling in Baghdad was, so far as I remember, unaccompanied by much regret from we who are of a conservative habit of mind. And thus fell a slave trader's monument. In the destruction of art's handiwork, art shows it matters, comes alive.
That was Matthew Paris. And finally, Kate Andrews.
America can often look, to outsiders, like a country of two warring tribes, the Trumpish anti-PC brigade and the woke Twitterati. Such divisions certainly exist. Our broadcasters are party political, and partisanship is deeply entrenched in America's two-party system. It's tempting to see the scenes in recent weeks as the continuation of tribal warfare by other means, but the truth is far more complicated. America has the most militarized and aggressive police force in the Western world. The country's legacy of rapid expansion, combined with vast geography and open landscapes, engendered a sense of lawlessness early on, and a need to be protected from it. This has led to an implicit social contract. Police need to be armed to match the criminals they're dealing with. It's the price for keeping the country safe. When the police bought vehicles that looked like tanks, or dressed as if they were off to war, we didn't ask questions. In theory, you knew it must go wrong sometimes. But what did going wrong look like? Who did it affect? It was hard to imagine. No longer. The ubiquity of smartphones means misdeeds are now filmed and shared instantly. We see America's police officers treat low-level offenders and even innocent citizens with the same force and aggression you would expect to see used against the most violent criminals. Black Americans feel the overwhelming brunt of the brutality. When the system goes wrong, they suffer the most. It's a common trap to glance at cherry-picked statistics and say nothing to see. Black Americans are no more likely to be shot by police than they were 5 years ago. Most who were shot were carrying guns. 14 of the 55 unarmed Americans shot by police last year were black. But despite accounting for 13% of the population, African Americans make up more than a quarter of the 1,000 fatal police shootings that take place each year. An unarmed black man is 4 times more likely to be fatally shot than his white counterpart. Over the past 2 decades, nearly 30,000 Americans have been registered dead at the hands of police. Causes of death include tasers, strongholds, and head injury. There is now growing awareness of these tactics, and it's forcing us to ask, are we okay with this? George Floyd was killed by a cop's knee shoved into his neck for nearly 10 minutes. He died by asphyxiation, not a gunshot, so his death wouldn't be registered on the fatal shootings list. But it registered with the nation, showing how out of hand police brutality is in America. It fits a trend. Earlier in lockdown, Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was shot dead by a former policeman and his son while out jogging in Georgia. Then there was Elijah Tufano, 14, punched and roughed up by a California cop for possession of a cigar. And Floyd is not the first time we've heard "I can't breathe" on camera. Eric Gardner uttered the same words 6 years ago when the police put him in a chokehold and strangled him to death for selling single cigarettes on the street. After protests, Floyd's killer was charged. So too were the cops who looked on. Their action and inaction exposes a culture, one that has been allowed to exist because not enough Americans thought it worth confronting. Their action and inaction exposes a culture, one that has been allowed to exist because not enough Americans thought it worth confronting. And of course, far-left protesters have joined the marches, but to focus on them is fundamentally to misunderstand what's happening. It's not about the murder of one man, but the countless black men Floyd's death represents and the warped social contract that has allowed it to happen. The justice reforms of the 1980s and 1990s have had the unintended effect of worsening race relations. Bill Clinton's war on drugs, using prison as its main tool, disproportionately puts black Americans behind bars. Drugs are used and sold equally by black and white Americans, but black Americans are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated for a drug offense. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court's establishment of qualified immunity for the police allows officers to only face punishment if their crime clearly infringes on an established, often technical right. This has encouraged appalling excesses. That's why we find former Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama calling for policy reform, and why former presidential candidate Mitt Romney was out on a march hosted by an openly left-wing campaign group. The right and left divide has broken down these past few weeks, driven by America's collective memory of its history of racism. What England remembers as the Victorian era, Americans remember as a time of slavery and the Civil War. Jim Crow is in living memory, as our parents and grandparents join Martin Luther King Jr. to march on Washington. It's fresh and raw still, in a way that is unique to the nation. The protests in Britain, as in America, have been used as cover for those with an agenda of violence and destruction, but most people marching will have done so in sympathy with America and to highlight issues that also exist in the UK. And there's one key difference. In both countries, we have seen videos of people throwing themselves between protesters and police, but in the UK, protesters have been stepping in to protect the police from stones and glass bottles. To this American, it was a very moving sight that emphasized the differences between policing in my homeland and my adopted country. America is policed by force, while the UK is policed by consent. Something worth holding on to.
That was Kate Andrews, and that's all for this week. Thanks very much for listening, and thanks to our producer, Gus Carter.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.